So here we are.
Hi.
It's been a minute.
Hi.
Well, because I think the last time we recorded, we were actually at my mom's house. Remember that?
Yes.
That's true.
That's like, when we planned the sleepover.
That's when we planned the sleepover, which was an epic decision.
It was an epic decision.
It was a good time. Had by all.
Yeah. Erin made some delicious gumbo last night. It was great.
Y'all, you missed out.
I kind of want some more right now. I always want gumbo.
You wish you had had that for breakfast?
Look, if y'all had not been here and I didn't have to, like, have breakfast food because normal people want breakfast food,
right?
I would have 100% had a leftover bowl of gumbo.
Fair enough.
I wouldn't have been mad at you if you did that.
With Louisiana hot sauce.
Not Frank's. Mornings.
Y'all, okay, so I'm just going to, you know that rule where you call yourself out first so no one else can? Like, that's what's about to happen. So I made gumbo last night, like Tammy said, and kind of, I think the secret to gumbo is like being able to eyeball everything, like not having to have exact measurements. And that's why it's never quite the same. But the time had come to put a little bit of hot sauce, and I don't like Tabasco. And Tammy had mentioned she doesn't really like Tabasco. So we're like, great. I have Louisiana at the house. Like, it's pretty good. It's got a good flavor. That's what I usually use. So I have prepped everything. I had chopped everything. It was all ready to go. The roux was almost done when they got here, and it's like starting to add all the stuff. And so it was time, the broth was in. It was time to add the hot sauce. And I just like very casually like gave it a kind of good healthy pour and stirred. And Tammy looked at me and she goes, I've never seen gumbo made with Frank's red hot sauce. And I'm like, well, it wasn't supposed to be. I just straight up grabbed the wing sauce and not the hot sauce. And
I will say it was still delicious.
You couldn't taste it. So yeah, that was not that's not the secret ingredient. That was the accident. Okay, I guess maybe we should talk about, like, podcasting and superstition and
what's an urban legend?
Well, an urban legend is a legend that comes from the urban area.
Is it?
No.
No, not usually.
I've had 3 cups of coffee, and I feel like I could use a couple more, to be honest. Do you remember how last time that we recorded and I did an episode, I told you how I started to research Missouri and then remembered that I wasn't doing Missouri?
Right.
Mm-hmm. This time I actually looked at the list so I would be sure to do the correct episode. And this time we are talking about Missouri.
Okay.
So, yeah, after
six
weeks of promising it, now we're doing it.
Here we are.
I just listened to that episode and I was cracking up.
I know, I laughed too. God. I'm like, I'm so stupid. have you guys ever been to Missouri?
Maybe through it.
It's just above Arkansas.
Yeah, because I've been to St. Louis, as Missouri, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my, yeah. On the way to Chicago.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. But not like specifically to go there.
So, you know my feeling in general of flyover states, but I actually really like Missouri, and I always have. So, when I was a high school junior, and we did, you know when you're a junior, you go on, like, the college trips and visits and stuff? So, my parents and I went to visit Mizzou, which is the University of Missouri, because it has the best journalism school in the country. And it absolutely does. It is the only collegiate, I was going to say collegiate chapter, like I'm talking about a sorority, but it's the only college that the news station that's part of the school is an actual affiliate of a larger broadcasting company. So I think it's an NBC affiliate, but it is the only one I know for a fact of any school in the country.
That's really cool. I didn't know
that. I loved it. It was a great school. I applied. I got accepted. I actually still have that acceptance letter. I found it the other day under the stairs. I don't know why I still have it.
Oh.
And I probably would have gone. But then at the beginning of my senior year, that's when 9/11 happened. And it just kind of made everybody reevaluate everything. And the idea of being almost 8 hours away from home and not being able to get home quickly.
Flying got a lot more complicated suddenly, too.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just kind of like I suddenly felt like I needed to be closer. And so I didn't go. But I think I would have enjoyed it. I could have been a Mizzou Tiger. Could have been the life. So I told a really long story that has nothing to do with any urban legends. welcome to my episodes. This is what I do.
This one doesn't happen at Mizzou.
No, it has nothing to do with Mizzou. It's just my only frame of reference for Missouri.
Fair enough.
Okay.
So we're going to do, I do need to probably get started because I have several pages of notes, but I looked up lots of different cities and legends, and the main one that kept popping up was the story of Momo the Monster.
Momo, no.
Not the Momo, one. The internet sensation.
Not Momo, the internet sensation.
I was like, no, the Momo challenge. Bring her up.
No, no,
it's
no.
So terrifying.
No, that was scary.
That was scary.
That was scary. Well, I need you to just settle in because this is a full-on story. So
I
get
love
ready.
Story time.
So this is the story of Momo the monster. Reports of hairy, human-like creatures comparable to the legendary Yetis of Tibet are older than American history. In a study that was published in the Info Journal of 1970, it was noted a vast folklore and a belief in a race of very primitive people with revolting habits is found from Northern California up to the Arctic lands themselves. This tradition covers not only the whole stretch of the Pacific coast, but much of the rugged territory to the east, even into Greenland. Generally, these sub-hominids are described as very tall, fully haired, and sometimes they are described as carnivorous. So
I wonder if they're related to the skunk apes.
I was just going
to
say, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the skunk ape. It's slightly different. I felt like the skunk apes were more gentle. Like, they were kind of described as gentle. But yeah, like, this is one of those urban legends that's of, like, a Yeti or a Bigfoot or a swamp thing or one of these big hairy creatures.
Momo
the monster. First Nations folklore and cultural artifacts such as masks, totem poles, and carvings exist in abundance, demonstrating the prehistoric knowledge of these creatures. So they date back before any of us were recording our own history. Native accounts discuss these half-men with words particular to each linguistic and tribal group. Among Euro-Americans, early reports talk of these beings with words like wild men and later gorillas. So as history starts to move, we start to see kind of this repetition of some of these similar things. Today, practically every state and province in North America has logged its share of Bigfoot reports. In the past several years, sightings have increased dramatically and probably will continue to grow. From the 1960s through the 90s, sightings of Bigfoot increased in many parts of the continent, but the ones in the eastern U.S. and Canada are some of the most problematic in mysterious America.
Ew.
Something different from the classical or traditional neo-giant is being seen. Could a different regional subspecies or even varied report be responsible for these sightings? This is the actual story of Momo. That was kind of the history of like Bigfoot-type creatures and Yetis across the U.S., so I apologize for the lengthy intro.
I'm ready for Momo.
On July 19th, 1972, a 20-man search party was organized in the small town of Louisiana, Missouri, because it makes sense to pick a state and name your city after it.
Sure.
To track down the huge, black, hairy beast that was being reported by local residents. Louisiana's police chief, Shelby Ward, was afraid that nervous residents would start shooting the monster and hit a local by mistake. The media whipped up a frenzy about the monster, and the quiet, unassuming community was launched into the national spotlight. The press humorously dubbed the reportedly foul-smelling creature Momo, which stood for Missouri Monster. That's how it got the name Momo.
I gotcha.
But local residents found the frightening encounters anything but funny. The Missouri Monster Scare actually began on July 11th, 1972, a hot midsummer afternoon. The first encounter with the creature occurred on the outskirts of Louisiana at the base of Marzoff Hill. An 8-year-old boy named Terry Harrison and his brother Wiley, 5, were playing with their dog in the woods at the edge of their yard. Suddenly, their older sister Doris, who was 15, she was inside the house at the time. She heard them screaming. That was a very poorly spoken sentence. She did this. She ran to look out the bathroom window and saw something standing by the tree.
Nope.
It was 6 or 7 feet tall, black and hairy, she said. It stood like a man, but it didn't look like one to me. She began crying and ran into the other room to call her mother on the telephone. Both Doris and Terry got a good look at the monster and agreed that the face could not be seen because of the mass of hair that covered its body. The creature seemed to have no neck, and it was flecked with blood, likely from the, the dead dog it was carrying under its arm.
Oh, no.
That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. I don't like that part of the story. The smell of the creature was said to have been horrendous, and it may have been this odor that made the Harrison's dog violently sick a short time after the incident.
Well, I would be scared, too, if I saw a dead dog under his arm.
I know. The dog's eyes grew red, and it vomited for hours afterwards.
Hmm.
At 4 o'clock that same day, Edgar Harrison, who was the children's father and a deacon in the local Pentecostal church, returned home from his job at the town waterworks. He did not find a monster, but he did find that the brush was beaten down where the children said the monster had been standing. He also found faint footprints in the dust and a few black hairs scattered about. That same afternoon, a woman who lived about 3 blocks away from the Harrisons Mrs. Clarence Lee reported that she heard animal sounds outside her home. Not long after that, she allegedly spoke with a farmer whose dog had disappeared.
Oh no.
Remembering the Harrison's children's report, she wondered if the monster had taken it. So this is all on July 11th. It was a long day with several sightings.
Yeah, 72.
1972. Mm-hmm. A couple days later, on July 14th, Edgar Harrison, again, that's the father of the kids, was conducting a regular prayer meeting at his home and soon after it ended, heard clanging sounds like someone was throwing rocks into the metal water reservoir on top of Marzoff Hill, which is the same hill where the kids saw it standing the first time. The reservoir was an attraction for neighborhood children, but it was unlikely that any of them would have been playing there at this hour. As he listened closely to the sounds, he heard one especially loud ring and then an animal-like growl. The sound came closer and closer and was so loud that his family came running out of the house. They urged him to leave the neighborhood, but Harrison wanted to see what was making the sound. Finally, he agreed to leave, and as he drove down Allen Street, he met about 40 people, some of them carrying guns, who were on their way to investigate the sounds at the reservoir. For some reason, Harrison shouted, "Here it comes," and the entire crowd turned away and ran. A number of people reported hearing the strange cries and screams that night, but by the time the police officers, Jerry Floyd and John Whitaker, arrived on the scene to investigate, they couldn't find anything out of the ordinary. Later that evening, Harrison and several friends explored Marzoff Hill, goodness, and found an old building from which a strong and unpleasant odor lingered. Harrison described it as a moldy horse smell or a strong garbage smell.
Sorry, moldy horse?
Yeah, are you not familiar with the moldy horse?
No.
I don't think
I would be able to identify that smell.
To be fair, when I was putting this together, I'm like, how does a horse mold? I mean, they typically are fairly mobile, but I mean, I'm not here to criticize what happened in 1972. It was before my time.
Sounds like another urban legend, the black mold horse.
I'd like you to make a note of that. Look it up for the next time.
Yep.
The creature continued to be seen in the days that followed, leading to Chief Ward's monster hunt on July 19th. So, you know, going on a week and a half at this point.
Yeah. Sorry. Sorry. I meant, yeah, but then there was a yawn.
That was a very enthusiastic yawn.
Yeah.
The monster hunting posse included Edgar Harrison and State Conservation Officer Gus Artis, and they covered Marzoff Hill and the surrounding area using two-way radios, but found nothing. While it was taking place, residents reported animal sounds in other parts of town. July 20th, more investigators joined the search and again combed the area behind the Harrison house and along Marzoff Hill. They found trampled brush, signs of digging, large tracks that were more than 10 inches long. Handprints were found pressed into the dry, hard soil, which investigators were convinced it would have taken immense pressure to make. They also smelled the beast, believing it was close, but still saw nothing. On July 21st, so now a full 10 days after the first sighting, the monster was seen again, this time on the Great River Road, which runs alongside the Mississippi River. Ellis Minor, a man who lived on the road, was sitting in front of his home late in the evening. It was dark, and suddenly his bird dog began to growl. Minor switched on a powerful flashlight that he used for hunting, and he spotted the monster about 20 feet away from him, standing in the middle of the road.
Nope. I feel like this podcast is me saying nope all the time.
Don't like that. I don't find a lot of things y'all do like, you know? Let's see. He told reporters that it had hair as black as coal, and he could not see its face because of the hair that hung down to its chest. As soon as I threw the light on it, he recalled, it whirled and took off that away.
That away.
Mm-hmm. He did not report the sighting to the police, but he did call the local conservation officer, who was one of the people in the hunting party a few days before. Mm-hmm. So, what we have is over 10 days, a report initially by children, but then later substantiated by a handful of other townspeople.
Yeah.
No one can really seem to get close. They all agree that he's super hairy, can't see any facial features, and he smells like a moldy horse. This is what we've learned.
I'm not over the moldy horse. I'm not over it.
I think that's now part of my permanent vernacular.
You smell like a moldy horse.
I'm going to say that to Kevin later, and he's going to be confused. By now, national publicity was turning Louisiana... You don't like that?
I'm sorry.
Tammy's just giving me the look. You're so dumb, Erin.
I'm just imagining this conversation and how it's going to go later. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be fine. It's going to be great. Let's see. So national publicity was turning Louisiana into a three-ring circus. People were driving in from surrounding states hoping to get a look at the creature. Edgar Harrison had become obsessed with trying to find a solution to this monster mystery. his family refused to come home, taking up residence in a restaurant that the family owned. And so his house kind of turned into a monster outpost.
Okay.
Can you imagine? You're like, sorry, Dad, I'm just not coming home. I'm going to live in the restaurant.
I'm out.
Whatever, you do what you got to do.
Wow.
It said the phones ring constantly. Meanwhile, Harrison had taken a leave of absence from his job at the waterworks to haunt the monster full time. So it's becoming a bit of an obsession, really.
What was Mr. Skunk Ape's name?
Dave?
Yes, Dave.
Dave of the Skunk Apes.
Dave of the Skunk Apes.
Good old Dave. We need to go visit Dave, you know, if we're ever allowed to travel again.
Right.
You know how every time we record, we're like, well, surely by the time this comes out, Corona will be over.
There's several episodes of that sentiment now.
Yeah, I give up. We're just gonna...
Done saying it.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just be surprised when it actually happens. Like, ah, yes. Life. Hello.
We're also traumatized. We won't believe it's real when it's real. But that's, you know, I digress.
It's
another story for another day.
It's another story for another time, because we're 16 minutes into it. Okay, so Harrison's house is the outpost. Family won't come home. He's hunting the monster full-time. In the company of friends and investigators, he camped out at the foot of the hill for 21 straight nights. And while he never saw the monster, he did hear it and smell it and noticed that whenever the searchers were onto something, they became overwhelmed by the terrible smell. So that's kind of the constant. Here's the smell.
The moldy horse smell.
During the last week of July, so at this point, it's basically taken most of the month, and into the early days of August, more prints were found south of town. More tracks were discovered in the early morning of August 3rd at the farm of Mr. and Mrs. Bill Sudarth, who lived just northwest of town. In the middle of the night, they heard a high-pitched howling in their yard and ran outside with flashlights to see what was going on. In the middle of the garden, they found four large prints. The man quickly called his hunting buddy, who drove over and made a plaster cast of the print. Penrod, who was the friend who made the cast, he was an outdoorsman, and he was puzzled by the entire affair. With the tracks being 20 feet away from anything else, he could not understand how they could have been made. They began abruptly in the center of the garden and ended just as mysteriously. So it sort of looked as though the creature just appeared in the center of the garden and then vanished.
Ghost Momo.
The monster Ghost Momo.
Yep.
Momo can apparate.
You know what? That's as good an explanation as anything else, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
They never found any tracks anywhere else on the property. There was no sign that it was any kind of a practical joke or how anyone would even have pulled that off. And this actually was the last encounter with the creature. So it ended as mysteriously as it began.
Interesting.
That discovery ended the Momo sightings and the encounters in Louisiana. And the story at this point, now, you know, 40 years later, is little more than a remembered curiosity. Actually, it's really closer to 50 years at this point. There are some people who still remember it, still talk about it. But for the most part, it's just kind of one of those bizarre, unexplained things that you might see on like a sci-fi channel. It started, it lasted almost a month, and then there was no answer to it.
That's different from most of the things that we've, like, researched, where it's, like, random sightings throughout history, mm-hmm. or, like, just a story people tell, but this was, like, a very specific
It was a moment in time. Yeah, because there were no ongoing sightings. It's not, like, over the next 40 years randomly... There are people who say, oh, yeah, no, I saw him. But it's, like, this was, like, so many different people saw the same handful of things. And so...
The moldy horse.
What do you think it was? Like, could it have been a person? Like, a savage person? Or...
But that does not explain how tracks just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's true.
What about an alien?
Could be an alien.
I vote that.
You vote on the alien?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there you go. That is the story of Momo. And I thought that was a little short, although I did so much extra talking, I probably could have turned that into one. But I thought we would go ahead and close out with a good ghost story.
I'm down for a ghost story.
Because I love me a good ghost story. So I will say, there was something when I was doing the research on this, this particular story, it just felt familiar. And I realized later, I think I heard this covered on another podcast. It was either And That's Why We Drink or maybe My Favorite Murder. I don't remember. But there was something that just kind of, like, kept connecting, but I didn't really remember it. And it's not a super traumatic story. It's just more... Anyway, I'll jump into it and let you... See if you recognize it and, you know, see how you feel after. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, we're now in St. Louis, Missouri, which is the big city. So we've gone from the little city to the big city.
Got it.
And this is said to be one of the 10 most haunted places in America. It's called the Limp... I'm sorry?
St. Louis is? Or this, oh, you were going to say something.
This particular home is said to be one of the 10 most, but I don't know what list that's from because I feel like everybody's got their own list.
Yeah.
BuzzFeed.
BuzzFeed, clickbait. You'll never believe number 9. Have you ever heard of the Lemp Mansion? That's harder to
Lump
say.
Mansion?
Lemp, L-E-M-P.
Oh,
Lemp Mansion.
Maybe. Sounds kind of familiar, but I couldn't tell you.
This is a very tragic story of the Lemp family and their home. So it was once the stately home of millionaires, and then it became an office space. It went to a rundown boarding house, and finally, its current state is it's a dinner theater, restaurant, and bed and breakfast.
Okay.
So depending on how you feel about this, if we ever decide to take a trip to St. Louis, we could hypothetically stay here.
I got it.
So this is the story.
Depends on what you tell me.
You used the word tragedy before, so I'm not sure how I'm going to
feel about it. I feel like Tammy does go with a healthy dose of skepticism into everything, though.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell me at the end how you feel.
Okay,
so this is the story of the Lemp family, which began with Johann Adam Lemp, who arrived in St. Louis from Germany in 1838. He built a small grocery store where he sold common household goods, groceries, and homemade beer. The light golden lager was a welcome change from the other darker beers that were sold at the time. So his mm-hmm. was just kind of different from everything else. So the recipe was actually handed down from his father back in Germany, and it was so popular that 2 years later, he actually gave up the grocery store entirely and built a brewery.
Oh, nice.
Close to where the Gateway Arch, the big arch.
Okay.
So that's kind of the area. And we're now at 1840. Okay, so it's 1840, and he's built this brewery. He actually first sold his beer in a pub that was attached to the brewery, introducing St. Louis to its very first lager. So he's kind of one of the leaders of the beer industry at the time.
Okay.
Very well.
By the time that he died, Adam Lemp was a millionaire, and his son William began a major expansion of the brewery. He purchased a 5-block area around the storage house on Cherokee, which I guess is the street, above the lagering caves. Okay, so to recap, because that was a little disjointed. Okay, so the Lemp family started with Johann Adam Lemp, who went by Adam.
Yeah.
Introduced St. Louis to lagers, and when he died, he had made enough money that he's now a millionaire. So his son William is taking over the business. He's expanding, and he's bought this whole general area, and there are caves below. The caves are important.
Okay.
All right.
So by the 1870s, the Lemp family symbolized both wealth and power as the Lemp Brewery controlled the St. Louis beer market, a position that it maintained until Prohibition. So they were kind of the front runners? No. Anyway, they were important.
They were important.
In 1868, William Lemp's father-in-law built a house a short distance from the brewery. In 1876, William Lemp purchased the house from his father-in-law for his own family. He utilized it as both a residence and an office. The house was already impressive, but he immediately began renovating it and expanding the 33-room house into a complete Victorian showplace.
Okay.
So at this point, the family now owns a mansion, a brewery, caves, and a 5-block radius. They're very, very wealthy. From the mansion, a tunnel was built from the basement through the caves to the brewery. So they've got their own secret way to get there.
Okay, I love a good secret. Like, because secret passageway.
Me too.
It's Prohibition at this point?
Not quite yet.
Oh, not yet.
This is kind of the build-up. They just maintained the sort of status until Prohibition.
Gotcha.
It was like the number one in the general area. From the mansion, a tunnel was built from the basement through the caves to the brewery. When mechanical refrigeration became available, parts of the cave were converted for other purposes, including a natural auditorium and a theater. This underground oasis would later spawn a large concrete pool with hot water piped in from the brewery boiling house and a bowling alley.
Okay.
I know. At one time, the theater was actually accessible by way of a spiral staircase from Cherokee Street. So I don't think I included it in these notes, but in my research, the reason these caves are so important is because there was not actual refrigeration at the time. So they were utilizing the natural formation of these caves to help with the brewing process. And you know, they've got this huge mansion, they've built this secret passage, and I think we're still with, William Lemp, the son, I believe. Yes, the son of the original guy.
Yeah.
He's turning this into like a spectacle. He's got a cinema. Mm-hmm. He's got a swimming pool. He's got a bowling alley. I mean, it's just like so much money, so much entertainment.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Sounds like Mount Vernon, the house in off of White Rock. It's got a swimming pool. It's got a bowling alley attached to it.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah, just one of those that's like more money than sense
kind
of thing.
Like, I'm sorry.
So by the middle of the 1890s, the Lempe Brewery gained a national presence after introducing the popular Falstaff beer, which is still brewed today by a different company.
Falstaff,
sorry. Oh, I don't know anything about beer. Yeah, so it's a different company now, but they were the original makers of that beer.
Interesting.
Well, I don't know how you actually pronounce it. Jerry Jeff Walker says Falstaff, that's why.
Well, he would definitely be my marker.
Yeah.
The Lempe Western Brewery was the first brewer to establish coast-to-coast distribution of any beer. And at the same time he was building his own business empire, William Sr. also helped Pabst, Anheuser, and Busch get started. So the
How cool.
The beer brewing industry was a pretty tight-knit.
Okay.
You didn't tell me this was a beer lesson.
In the midst of this success, the Lempe family experienced the first of many tragedies when Frederick Lempe, which was William Sr.'s favorite son and apparent heir, died in 1901 at the age of 28. This is now the grandson of the original guy, because yep. I know there's a lot of names here. Frederick, who had never been in extremely good health, died of heart failure. The devastated William was never the same. He began a slow withdrawal and was rarely seen in public after his son's death. On January 1st, 1904, William's closest friend, Frederick Pabst, of Pabst Beer, also died, leaving William indifferent to the details of running the brewery. Though he still arrived at the office each day, he was nervous and unsettled. His physical and mental health began to decline. He was in a deep depression. Lost his favorite son, lost his friend. On February 13th, 1904, he shot himself in the head with a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson. In November of 1904, William Lempe Jr. took over as the new president of the William J. Lempe Brewing Company. Inheriting the family business and a vast fortune, he and his wife Lillian began to spend the inheritance. They filled the house with servants. The pair spent a huge amount on carriages, clothing, and art.
All right.
This is now the grandson of the original grocer.
Yeah,
so
okay.
We're two generations deep. Lillian, that's the wife, was a beautiful woman who came from a wealthy family herself. She and William Lempe Jr. married in 1899, and William J. Lempe III was born on September 26, 1900. Before long, Lillian became known as the Lavender Lady because of her fondness for the color. In addition to her lavender attire and accessories, she went so far as to have her carriage horses' harnesses dyed lavender. In the beginning, Will enjoyed showing off his trophy wife, but soon began to tire of her.
This is sounding familiar now.
Yes. It took me some time to figure it out, too.
Uh-huh.
In the meantime, Will was running the brewery during the day and pursuing all manner of decadent activity during the night.
Of course he was.
He held lavish parties in the caves below the mansion. He would bring in numerous prostitutes for the entertainment of his friends. They enjoyed the swimming pool, the bowling alley, and the free-flowing beer. His friends who attended these lavish events were known to enjoy a high time in the earth below. But Will's shenanigans caught up with him when he sired a son with a woman other than his wife. Today, there is no official documentation that this boy existed.
Oh.
However,
so sad.
The rumors that this boy was hidden in the mansion's attic for his entire life have been prevalent over the years. According to the St. Louis historian, Joe Gibbons, when he interviewed a former nanny and chauffeur who worked at the mansion long ago, both of them verified that the boy did exist and was housed in the attic quarters, which also housed the servants' rooms. Spawned from Will's philandering with either one of the many prostitutes or perhaps a mansion servant, they were never really able to confirm who the mother was, the boy was born with Down syndrome. He was an embarrassment to the family and was hidden away from the world in order to hide Lempe's shame. He is known today as the monkey face boy.
Uh-huh.
This unfortunate soul continues to show his presence in the Lempe mansion. He lived his whole life in the attic.
Wow.
Yeah. I think this was, because I don't listen to both of those, but I think they did do an episode on.
Yeah, it sounds familiar. So finally, William Jr. tired of his trophy wife and filed for divorce in 1908. Why she didn't take the step with all the goings-on could be nothing more than a sign of the times. Women didn't really have much independence. The court proceedings surrounding the divorce became a major St. Louis scandal, with all foreign St. Louis newspapers devoting extensive front-page coverage to the messy affair. The trial opened in February 1909 to crowds that flocked to the courthouse each day to witness the drama of tales, violence, drunkenness, atheism, and cruelty. Virtually ignoring William's decadent activities, Lillian almost lost custody of William Lempe III because of a photograph that was present at the trial that showed her smoking a cigarette.
Wow.
Just take a moment for that. Take a moment to process that.
Jeez.
In the end, she did retain custody of their son, but soon retired from the public eye. The only time she was ever seen wearing anything other than lavender was on the final day of her divorce proceedings when she appeared entirely in black before the judge. But with the divorce, Will's troubles had only begun. In 1906, 9 of the large breweries in the St. Louis area combined to form the Independent Breweries Company, creating fierce competition that the Limp Brewery had never faced. In that same year, Will's mother died from cancer on April 16th. So it was a tough year for Will. Though the brewery fortunes were continuing to decline, the Limp Mansion was renovated entirely in 1911 and partially converted into offices for the brewery. At the same time, William allowed the company's equipment to deteriorate without keeping on top of industry innovations. Mm-hmm. So by World War I, the brewery was just barely hanging on. Then Prohibition came in 1919. The individual family members were already wealthy, so there was little incentive to actually keep that brewery afloat. For a time, Will hoped that Congress would repeal Prohibition, but he finally gave up and closed the Limp plant down without notice. The workers learned of the closing when they came to work one day, found the gates and doors shut and locked.
That is rude.
Yes, terribly rude. On March 20th, 1920, Elsa Limp Wright, which was William's sister, the wealthy heiress in St. Louis, shot herself just like her father had years before. She was said to have been despondent over a rocky marriage. Liquidating the assets of the plant and auctioning the buildings, William Jr. sold the famous Limp Falstaff beer logo to brewer Joseph something, mm-hmm. for $25,000 in 1922.
Oh my gosh.
I know. The brewery buildings were sold to the International Shoe Company for $588,000, a fraction of its estimated worth of $7 million in the years before Prohibition.
Wow.
Just a tiny fraction. After the end of Limp's brewing dynasty, William Jr. slipped into a deep depression. Acting much like his father, he became increasingly nervous and erratic, shunning public life and complaining of ill health. On December 29th, 1922, William shot himself in the heart with a .38 caliber revolver same building where his father had died 18 years before.
Oh, it's poor family.
William Jr. took his life on the main level of the mansion, just inside the entrance to the left. At the time of his death, this room served as his office. He was interred in the family mausoleum in Bellefontaine Cemetery in the crypt just above his sister Elsa. So in 18 years, father, sister, son all killed himself in the same manner. In 1943, another tragedy occurred when William Limp III died of a heart attack at the age of 42.
Oh my gosh.
One of William Jr.'s brothers, Charles, eventually remodeled the mansion back into a residence and lived in the house alongside two servants and the illegitimate child of his brother William. Remember the poor kiddo? Charles, too, became an odd figure as he grew older. Developing a morbid fear of germs, his obsessive compulsive behavior included wearing gloves at all times to avoid bacteria and constantly washing his hands. It was during this time that William's illegitimate child, now in his 30s, died at the mansion. He was buried in the Limp Cemetery plot with only a small flat marker with the word Limp.
Mm.
Shortly after the monkey faced boy's death, Charles became the fourth member of the Limp family to commit suicide. He climbed the staircase to his room on the second floor and shot himself. He was discovered on May 10th, 1949 by one of his staff still holding a .38 caliber Army Colt revolver in his right hand. So not the same gun, but the same kind.
Yeah.
Of the Limps, only the final brother, Edwin Limp, who had long avoided the life that had turned so tragic for the rest of his family, remained. He was known as a quiet, reclusive man who walked away from the Limp Brewery in 1913 to live a peaceful life on a secluded estate in Kirkwood, Missouri.
Smart man.
Smart man. He passed away quietly of natural causes at age 90 in 1970, and the Limp family line died out with him.
Okay.
After the death of Charles Limp, the mansion was sold and turned into a boarding house. Along with the nearby neighborhood, the building began to deteriorate, and that's when the tales of the haunting began. Residents complained of ghostly knocks, phantom footsteps being heard throughout the house. And as these stories spread, tenants were hard to find for the boarding house, and it continued to decline until it was basically a flop house status. In 1975, the old mansion was saved when a man named Dick Pointer and his family purchased it. Immediately, they began to renovate the building, turning it into a restaurant and an inn. Workers within the house have told stories of apparitions, strange sounds, vanishing tools, and a general feeling of being watched. Frightened by the hauntings, many would leave the job site and never return. Since the restaurant is open, staff members have still report strange experiences. Again, apparitions appear and then quickly vanish. Voices and sounds seem to come from nowhere, and glasses often lift off the bar and fly through the air by themselves.
That's not okay.
I would love that. Other occasions, doors are said to lock and unlock by themselves. Lights inexplicably
lights turn off and on of their own free will. Wow. And the piano bar often plays when no one is near. It's said to be haunted by several members of the Limp family, but there are three areas of the old mansion that have the most activity. The stairway, the attic, and what the staff refer to as the gates of hell in the basement.
Oh.
It's this area of the basement that used to be the entrance to the caves below the mansion and the brewery. The attic is said to be haunted by William Jr.'s illegitimate son. Strange occurrences are often witnessed on the third floor of the mansion. The face of the boy has regularly been seen from street parking by the small windows of the mansion. Ghost investigators have often left toys in the middle of his room, drawing a circle around them to see if the objects have moved, and consistently, when they return the next day, the toys are found in another location.
Wow.
In the downstairs bathroom, which was once William Jr.'s personal domain and held the first freestanding shower in St. Louis, many women have reported seeing a man peeking over the stall. On one such occasion, a woman emerged from the bathroom returning to the bar and stated to the two men she was there with, "Well, I hope you got an eyeful." And the two men quickly denied having ever left the bar, for which the bartender also verified. This ghost is said to be that of the womanizing William Jr.
Yes.
In William Limp Sr.'s room, guests have reported hearing someone running up the stairs and kicking at the door. When William killed himself, William Jr. was known to have run up the stairs to his father's room, and finding it locked, began to kick the door to get to his father. So they think they're hearing that played over again. Several years ago, a part-time tour guide reported hearing the sounds of horses outside the room where William Limp Sr. had kept his office. However, when the tour guide looked through the window, nothing was there. This area, north of the mansion, and now used as a parking lot, was once used as a tethering lot for horses.
The moldy horses?
The moldy horses. This mansion has been featured in a number of magazine articles and newspapers and now attracts ghost hunters from around the world. Today it features a bed and breakfast with rooms restored in period style, a restaurant featuring fine dining, and a mystery dinner theater. Tours are also available at the mansion.
I wouldn't hate doing a movie, like a dinner theater.
You don't want to stay there, but you'll go for the dinner theater.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's 11:11 now.
And it's 11:11.
That is magical. I saw my phone light up and I'm like, Tammy, oh hi.
I wasn't sure when you were going to stop, but I didn't want to.
Sorry, I know that was a super long episode.
No, I think that's so interesting, though. I liked that story.
I did too.
Except for how sad and awful it was.
I wanted Momo to be the one, but like there wasn't enough of that. But
yeah.
Then I think there was too much of that one, so I'm going to have a good time cutting this episode down.
Thanks for listening to Salt Over Your Shoulder,
a Redwater production.
We appreciate your support. Your download allowed our crazy idea to gain steam and make it into your podcast directories. We couldn't do this without you. If you'd like to continue your support, you can engage with us on social media, on Twitter and Instagram at SaltThePod, or follow us on Facebook at SaltOverYourShoulder. You can also email us at saltoveryourshoulder@gmail.com.
Special thanks to the one and only Andrew York for our awesome graphic.
If you'd like to continue your support, please consider giving us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast directory. This helps other people find us as well. You can also become one of our patrons at patreon.com.